it's pretty demoralizing to go into firms and you can't get past the reception. They're just not interested. But my dad told me, 6 out of 10 are going to throw you out. So be ready for it. You have to be honest. And I've tried to be that throughout my career. You must be 100% honest. You know, you can't kid anybody. Warren Buffett's 93. I haven't got his money, but he's 93. And his partner was 99 before he passed away because they kept their minds active. My lawyer said, right, you've finished this nightmare. Annabelle's? I said, no, bed.
Hello and welcome to the School of Hard Knocks, a six-part series brought to you by EG Property Podcasts. I'm Sam McClary and I'll be your host. Over the course of this series, we've been meeting people who have lived through some of the highs and lows of this wonderful business of real estate. And through our conversations, we've dug deep into the skills, the mindsets and the structures you need in place to successfully navigate tricky times. Originally designed as part of EG's Next Generation project to provide a tool for people in real estate who may have only worked during a period of low interest rates and high activity, what follows is a series of conversations I guarantee everyone will find helpful, inspiring, and dare I say it, even a little bit entertaining. In this penultimate lesson in the School of Hard Knocks, I'm joined by Neil Sinclair, founder extraordinaire and a man who won't stop until he's achieved what he's set out to do. With more than 60 years' experience in real estate, some high highs and some very low lows, Neil has managed to stay grounded. He's driven by honesty and a passion for his charitable work. This lesson is rampant with advice about how to take a hard knock and how to stay passionate about the work that you do. There's too much to put into this opening gambit from me, so I think we should just jump straight in. You know the drill by now. Go grab that pen and paper, because it's time to enroll yourself in the School of Hard Knocks. Listen hard and enjoy, because graduation promises a grounding to navigate any of the knocks the economy may throw your way. Enjoy. Welcome, Neil Sinclair, to the School of Hard Knocks. I think this is lesson number 5.
Wow.
Lesson number 5 of 6 for series 1. And I'm really pleased that you've agreed to come and join us in the school, because I know that you're going to have some really great lessons for our listeners. Because when I was thinking about how I'd pitch this conversation, I suppose I kind of think, when I think of you, the phrase that comes into my head is, you can't keep a good man down. Because you've recently come back,
yes.
Doing it all over again, and we'll get to that in a bit. But
sure.
I guess let's first introduce our audience to you. For those who don't know Neil Sinclair, you've been in this business for 50 years?
Nope.
More? Less?
63.
63 years, and you're
I came into the business in 1960.
Wow. So tell us about that. What brought you into real estate? And you've founded many companies since then, so we'll talk through those. But what brought you to this weird and wonderful world of real estate?
So when I was at school, you know, we had the GCSEs and all that sort of stuff, and I actually wanted to be a pharmacist, and I inquired at the Chelsea College of Pharmacy. I was really keen on being a pharmacist, but biology was a weak subject for me, and I took the view that I don't really want to take subjects where I'm going to struggle a bit. That wouldn't be clever. So I then looked at the law. And in those days, if you wanted to be a lawyer, solicitor, you had to do 5 years articles. And you get about £1 a week if you're lucky. And for whatever reason, I didn't fancy that either. So I then looked at the possibility of going into real estate. And I took the decision in July 1960, that's what I want to do. But that's the easy part. The difficult part is getting into it in the first place.
Mm.
And people forget that in the 60s, it was very difficult to get a job. If you hadn't been to public school, which I had not, many firms just wouldn't even interview you. The well-known ones, you couldn't get in there. You had to be a particular type. And I found it incredibly difficult to find a job. So what I did, and I've been doing it for 2 years, I had a Saturday job at a menswear company, which is now owned by Boss. And I worked on Saturday, but then I worked in the holiday. And it was a great experience because I worked in this shop in Shepherd's Bush. And it was round the corner to the BBC Theatre. So all these BBC icons used to come into the shop. Benny Hill, all these sort of people.
Did he run around it?
Yeah, it was great. It was great. But that's not what I wanted to do. But to be honest, I found it very, very difficult to get a job. And by September, I had nothing. And I was contemplating doing something else. And I spoke to my father. And I said, look, I'm really getting nowhere. And he said, son, if you want a job, you've got to knock on the door. And he said, what you got to do, he said, is there a directory of surveying firms in central London? And I said, there is. I said, right. He said, pick out all these firms that you might want to work for, jump on a tube, go up the West End or city, and walk in and ask for a job. Out of every 10 you'll walk into, 6 will throw you out, 2 will tell you to write to them, 1 will hum and haw, but 1 will see you because you had the audacity to walk in and ask for a job. And that's what I did. And anyway, you can't believe it, but I met another guy on the train going up who was going to do exactly the same thing. And we decided it wasn't clever that both of us would go into the similar firm. So we tossed a coin and we said the winner can choose whether they go north of Bruton Street or south. Because it was all the firms were in Mayfair then. And I won, so I said, I'll take the north and he'll take the south. I then, in the meantime, got offered a job from months earlier, which I actually took, and I lasted 2 days. It was terrible in there. Nobody smiled, there was no humour. And I said to my father, I said, I'm not sure I can stand all this. And he said, son, if you don't like it, leave on Friday. And do you know, before Friday came, I got 2 offers from companies that I'd walked into and asked for a job. And I took one of them, and that's how I started.
Where was that?
So it was a firm called Moss & Partners in South Moulton Street. I got £4 a week.
Better than a tea, pound.
Pound, yeah. Made the tea, did all that stuff. And there were 2 guys I particularly worked for in there called Smith and Melzack and Michael Smith, who eventually became Smith Melzack, became quite a big firm. But Moss were quite an active firm at the time. And I parallel it to today, because that's how you learn. I listened to these guys on the phone. I went with them on appointments, all that sort of stuff. And I really fear for young people who are not getting that benefit by being at home. Mm. It's a great danger. And I learned a tremendous amount from these guys. And it was a great experience. And my dad, who unfortunately for me died when I was only 20, he went to see Lewis Moss. He thought he'd go and see him. And he said, look, I want you to give me the truth. Why did you take on my son? He said, simple. 1, he walked in, and I like that. But secondly, can I really lose money on £4 a week? That's what he said. And my dad burst out laughing. In fact, both burst out laughing. And that was that. And that's how I started.
It's a really good lesson you've already shared, which is knock on the door. And I think that's, you know, the only way you're going to find opportunity is by knocking on the door.
On anything.
Yeah.
You know, you really have to be, I mean, they call it today business development, don't they? But I always tell people I'm a door knocker. You know, I can always get to somebody if I need to. And you've just got to knock on the door and ask. And a lot of people don't ask. And some people, through their own character, can't do that. But I learned I had to do that. And if I hadn't have done it, I wouldn't have got a job. So I was very pleased that I did it. I'm pleased that my dad told me to do it. The other guy that went south of Bruton Street, he landed up in a firm in Piccadilly. Exactly the same. Hmm. You know, so there is a way of doing it. Whether you could do it today, walk in and ask and all that, I don't know. But I did it, and that's how I started.
I'm sure today you could do it so metaphorically, couldn't you? I want to continue with the history of your career in a bit, but while we're on the subject of doors and knocking, in that period, did you have any of those doors sort of slam in your face? And
loads.
How did you deal with that?
I had loads. You know, it's pretty demoralising to go into firms and you can't get past the reception. They're just not interested. But my dad told me 6 out of 10 are going to throw you out. So be ready for it. So it wasn't like a shock. Hmm. So I expected it. And his analysis actually was right. Because in fact, it was about 10% that I actually got interviews with. But I would never have got them if I had just sent in my CV. Hmm. I would never have gotten. And that, I think, is a lesson I've never forgotten.
And that, I know when we've spoken before, that has sort of been a sort of theme throughout your career, hasn't it? I know when we've talked about your time with Palace, and yes. You would go to places. You wanted to walk and see and feel the
Absolutely.
Real estate. So being out there in the physicality of it. Or
well, you've got to understand it, you know, and... I mean, at Palace, as you know, we focused on the regions.
Yep.
And I got to know the regions incredibly well, you know, so I know them now.
Knocking on all of those doors too.
Absolutely.
So, Moss, were you there for the 10 years before?
I was there for about probably 6-9 months. I then took a job with a firm in Holborn, only for a few months. That didn't quite work out. And then I went to a firm called Kenneth Brown, which became part of John D. Wood.
Hmm.
And I went to Kenneth Brown, and I'm quite proud of the fact I became a partner when I was 21, which was pretty young, really.
Yeah.
That was, what, 1964 or something, you know. And that was probably the start of the first recession. The Labour government came in and brought in restrictions on office development and all that sort of stuff. And life got very difficult. But I was on the Central London leasing side, so I was not really affected on the development front, but we were affected because the economy was in a difficult position.
Hmm. So you were a young partner.
Yeah.
The economy is tanking. How do you, there's probably quite a lot of expectation on you. How do you deal with that?
There was, but what happens in a recession, right, is there's always demand somewhere.
Mm.
And you've got to find that demand, and it's going to be, and the rents and prices are going to be at different levels, and you just have to learn to adjust, learn to change. Life is not the same, and you must be prepared to accept it. And as young as I was, I accepted it. And I still remember, I was, before I became a partner, I was 18 or 19. Kenneth Brown's father-in-law had bought this huge site, which in Camden, which is the back of Camden Lock, and it's where Morrison's and, I mean, it was huge. It went all the way up Jamestown Road. It was a huge thing. And it was the old distillery for Gilby's Gin. And he bought it. It was huge, you know. And sort of at a very young age, I was dealing with it, you know. And it was a really a great experience, you know. And his father-in-law had quite a bit of property. And I'd gotten particularly well with him as young as I was. And I gained a lot of experience through dealing with that. And that site, where it was developed over many, many years. And looking back, his father-in-law said, Camden one day will be up there, but maybe not in the immediate future. And he was right. You know, he was 100% right.
Mm.
You know, but the fact was, that was great experience learning all that sort of thing. But the recession came, and I just had to adapt. We still did deals. And I'm very proud of the fact that it must be in 1964 or 5. I did probably Gerald Ronson's first decent-sized deal. We bought a two office buildings in Victoria, maybe 1964 or something, off Mirror Group newspapers. And you learn how to do these types of deals. Mirror Group newspapers wanted to sell the properties, and they weren't rushing to go to the market. And this is where the door knocking comes in. I got in touch with Mirror Group because I knew they owned the freeholds. And in those days, it was very difficult because you couldn't do searches to find out who owned what and all that sort of stuff. You can now, of course. We couldn't then. But I found out they owned it, got in touch with the property director. And he actually said, we intend to sell this in the next 12 months. And I said, if you get the right proposal, would you sell it earlier? And he said, the right proposal, we would. And I was quite friendly with Gerald at the time. And cut a long story short, he bought it. He bought it. There were two buildings, one of 30,000 feet, one of about 10. And we got quite a long completion. And in that period, we pre-let the 30,000 feet to Tate and Lyle. It was a cracking deal, whichever way you look at it. but I was only about 20 or 21 when I did that. That's quite young, really. And in the same year, I remember, it was very important for us to buy buildings for property clients and not only get the acquisition fee, but get the letting, which was very important. And I bought a building in Old Park Lane for London Merchant Securities, which is now Derwent. And we bought this building in Old Park Lane. I remember it was only £250,000, which is ridiculous now. And we bought this building, and then we let it to the Women's Voluntary Service. you know, so we got the letting and all that sort of stuff. And that's really, we built up a sort of portfolio of buildings that we were handling to lease. And that, and I mirrored that when I eventually went on my own. That's what we decided to do.
And before we move to Sinclair Goldsmith, which is your first company that you launched, I just want to stick on that buy and lease, at the, you know, thinking about that life cycle, I suppose, of a building. And is that something that you would recommend to people now, that if you're a capital markets person and you are buying and trading buildings for significant amounts now, do you need to think about who's the end user of this building?
Yes.
I'm actually gonna, if I want something, particularly in these times when valuations are going up and down, I need to think about that whole package of a building.
Very important. That's what we always looked at, right? Who's going to take this building? What might we get for it? And you also have to have, it's not fortune telling, it's just where you think the market's going. And I still remember we bought a site for a client in High Holborn, and it was on the market, and there were several people after it. But this client particularly wanted it. The problem was they were a subsidiary of a public company, and they had to get the public company to agree that they could buy this property. And what it came to, I had to write a report saying what the rents were now, and then based on my knowledge, what do I think we're going to get when the building is ready, assuming there's no events that happen in the meantime, of which we have no control. So I projected a rent, I still remember it, but I said that the time this building is ready, I think there'll be a recovery in the market and rents will be 40% more than now. And I remember the client said, are you prepared to put your money where your mouth is? I said, yes. So what I will do, we will have a sort of average fee if we just get the rent that's the rent now. But if we get the rent that I think we're going to get, we'd like an incentive. And they had no problem with that, right? They gave us an incentive. And in fact, we got a bit more than we thought we would get. And they eventually sold it. We let it to Kodak, who were huge then, not now, but no. Huge then. And then Kodak bought the freehold. It was an incredible deal. Kodak wanted to buy the building initially. We said no, because I said to the client, don't let them buy it, lease it to them, and then sell it to them on the back of their own covenant. And they sold it to a big pension fund, made a huge amount of money, and we got probably one of the best fees we ever got, you know, but that's what we did. You know, sometimes you've got to write down what you think, but you must put your caveat in there, you know, cases of Ukraine or whatever might happen. But I remember that. So.
And that means that the fundamentals of real estate, if you know this industry, stay the same. Yes, we can't control the uncontrollables, but if we're aware of them, the fundamental stuff is still there.
The fundamental is still there, but you have to be honest. And I've tried to be that throughout my career, both in with lettings and with banks. You must be 100% honest. You know, you can't kid anybody, none of that stuff. I think that's very important. And I gave my reasons when I wrote this note to this client, why I thought the rent could get to that level, because I was looking at what else was going to become available. And I foresaw a shortage. And I thought, well, that can only mean rents rising. And gratuitously, they did.
Well done. So let's move on to the start of your founding careers, I suppose. So first started staying in the advisory world, with Sinclair Goldsmith, a company you founded in 1970?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about why you did that, how you did it, and the story from, let's carry on the story from there.
So the reason I started was the firm where I was a partner. I didn't feel I was getting the reward for the business I was doing. So I still remember I had a word with my mum, you know, because I've always said that, you know, I'm a great believer in women's intuition. And I said to my mum, I said, I'm not really happy. So I said, I've got two choices. I can move to another company or I can go on my own. But the problem going on my own is that takes money. And she said, well, if you want to go on your own, do it now. Because if you don't, you might regret it. And so think about that. And so I decided to go on my own. And a few months after I decided, Peter Goldsmith phoned me and said, I hear you're thinking of going on your own. I said, I am. He said, so am I. Why don't we have a coffee? Which we did. And we agreed to go together. I left in May 1970. I had particular difficulty with my old partner. It's no secret. He owed me money, which I never got. And I had to sue for it. I got it 3 years later. But in the meantime, I needed working capital for my company. And gratuitously, I had a really lovely bank manager. And I asked for an overdraft facility. And he said, "And what security are you offering?" And I said, "You're looking at it." And he burst out laughing. Oh, he said, "Okay, go away," you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I never used it, but I had the backdrop to have that. But then we had an issue that Peter couldn't get out of the company he was with. He was a partner of Cyril Leonard, and they wouldn't let him go. They refused to let him go. So I actually started as Neil Sinclair & Co. And Peter was getting really upset, you know, that he couldn't get out. But I was very, very fortunate. I had this lawyer at the time, a guy called Arnold Finer, who became Finers. Probably the greatest legal brain I've ever dealt with. And he said, "What's the problem with Peter?" I told him. He said, "Leave him to me." And Peter goes to see him, and I swear to you, the following day, Peter turns up at my office. He said, "We are now Sinclair Goldsmith." I said, "What happened?" He said, "I don't know where you found this lawyer, but he's a genius." I said, "What did he do?" He said he telephoned the partner, Cyril Leonard. He said, "This is a letter I'm about to send you. I'm going to read it to you, and then you will tell me whether you want me to send it." And he read the letter, and the guy said, "I'd rather you didn't." And that was it. And they released him. And to this day, I don't know what was in the letter.
I was going to say, did you ever find out?
I don't know what was in there. And he turned up the following day. So that's how we got it going.
And a successful partnership for quite a long time.
Yeah, yeah. So it went really well. And we worked on the premise that we wanted to buy as many buildings for property clients as we could. So we would have the letting, and then we would possibly have the investment sale. So it wasn't just one fee, it could be three. So we built that up. But of course, we then hit recessionary times in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. Life got really difficult. The transactional business was really difficult. But we survived it. You know.
Tell me about some of the hardest times and how you survived those and what you learned from them.
Well, it's quite interesting. So even in those days, we were thinking about our pensions and all that sort of stuff, you know. And Peter and I had this property in Greek Street. And we were with some other people on it. And we had this property in Greek Street. It was vacant. And the market crashed. And the loan on the property was twice the value. Not good news.
Mm-mm.
So we knew we were going to get a call from the bank. And the bank was the Bank of Nova Scotia. And we get a call from the manager. "Can you come and see me?" And we knew exactly what it was about. And we were in our early 30s. And he said, "Look, boys, I love you dearly, but we want our money back." And we said, "Well, we thought you'd say that, but we haven't got the money to give you back." And he was very disappointed, but I don't think surprised. I said, "We have a plan." He said, "You have a plan?" I said, "Yes." I said, "We've worked out that in the end, we think we can get you all your money back. But you have to do one thing." He said, "What's that?" "Lend us more money." So he burst out laughing and he said, "What are you talking about?" So we actually took a presentation to him and we said, "Look, the market's terrible. Could we sell it now?" "Yes, but you would lose 50% of your loan. Do you want to do that?" He said, "No, I don't." "Right, so there's three options. Sell it now and do that. Do nothing. Or lend us more money." He said, "What do you want the money for?" I said, "We want the money to go and get planning permission to develop the property. If we get consent, the market's terrible, contractors are crying out for work, we'll build it. By the time it's ready, the economy should be in recovery. And we think you'll get all your money back. And we did all the figures, did all that. He said, we're never going to do that. So I said, would you do me one favour? Would you send it to your head office in Toronto and ask them? He said, that I will do, but I won't recommend it or reject it. We heard nothing for a month, and then this guy called Art Crockett, never forget him.
Great name.
Rings me, yeah, great name, rings me up. From Toronto, he said, I'm coming to London on bank business. I want to meet you and your partner. I want to see the property, and then I'll take you to lunch and we'll talk about it. Anyway, he comes over and meet him, and he gives me his card. I remember it this day. He is president of the bank. He is the number one guy. So I said to him, pardon me asking, this is small beer for you. Why are you talking to us? He said, because what you're proposing is a departure from what we've ever done. And this will need a board decision, as small as it is. I said, okay. So we took him to the property, went into the whole thing with him. He took us to lunch. And he said, I don't think we'll do it, but I'll put it to the board. We never heard a word for a month. And he phoned me. He said, you got your money. And I couldn't believe it. And I thanked him. I said, I can't thank you enough. He said, no. He said, you've got this wrong. I said, why is that? Well, he said, I'm sitting in our board meeting. And I realized we had three loans on prime property in downtown Toronto. And I said to the board, you know what? We should do what they're doing. We should build it now, ready for the recovery, with contractors being very competitive. So he said, so I'm going to thank you, he said, because you gave us the idea. Because we think you're right. The outcome was we got planning, we developed it, we let it, we sold it to the Prudential. Bank of Nova Scotia got all the money back, and we got back probably 90% of our money. So, I mean, they call that a workout, don't they?
Yeah.
And it happened to me again 15 years later with the Bank of Scotland. Exactly the same thing happened. When the market fell in 1990, and we built this building and we let it to the government, and then we sold it and they got all the money back. So it's the right thing to do, provided your property's in the right spot.
I can understand how you had the confidence in the 1990s to go to Bank of Scotland to say, hey, we've done this already, look, see how it works. What gave you the confidence with Bank of Nova Scotia to say the best thing for you to do is to give us more money when they've just asked for their money back?
I think they knew we were honest, and we were telling them that the market's terrible and we're not trying to kid them. And I think he appreciated that, and he looked at it, and I said, look, it's 1974, I think it was, or 75 or something like that. And I said, if we're not in recovery by the time this building is ready, we're all in trouble. And he agreed, right? And he looked at it, and there was nothing we said that derogated. And we had a very good relationship with them afterwards. They actually didn't, they not long after decided not to lend on property anymore in England. But they were a great bank to deal with. But I think also with the Bank of Scotland, we knew them well. We used the Bank of Scotland to float our company, British Lenin Bank in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
They did our float. They were terrific. So we had this very close relationship with Bank of Scotland. And we had a loan on this property in Kentish Town, actually. And suddenly the market crashed. And we had exactly the same problem. But we did exactly the same thing. We got them to give us more money. We got the planning. We built it. We let it to the government. and we refinanced and gave them the money back. So
there's definitely a theme here, because I know Kevin McCabe, our first lesson, had the same relationship with the same bank.
Yeah.
And
they were great. They were absolutely great. I mean, British Lenin, when we're doing our float of Sinclair Goldsmith in 87, we were looking to float. But people forget there was a problem then. I don't know, you might not know this, but in the 80s, the first agency firms to float were residential. It was Bairstow Eaves and Mann & Co. in the early 80s. The problem was, if you're chartered surveyors, you were not allowed to raise external capital. And if you did, you got struck off. So that's what happened to the guys at Bairstow Eaves. They all got struck off. And a little while later, a firm called Henry Butcher, it was found that they had got into difficulty a few years earlier. Somebody had rescued them but taken a stake. It was against the RICS rules. And all the partners got struck off. I mean, ridiculous. But gratuitously, in 1986, I became chair of the RICS in central London. And we all agreed we've got to get rid of these cobwebs. It is ridiculous. So we looked at three things. We looked at allowing external capital into firms that you could go public. We wanted to allow contingency fees. And we wanted to end graduate entry only. And all three were scrapped, right? We recommended it, and the council of the RICS agreed to it. So when we came to do our float, there was still the danger that this wasn't going to go through, and we could be struck off. And if that was going to happen, we wouldn't have floated, because we had a big business in the City of London, and that wouldn't have been clever.
No.
But it got lifted, and so we used. And when we decided to float, our bank was Barclays, been there right at the beginning, went to see them in Piccadilly Circus, were thinking of floating, do you want to haggle the float? And they said, of course we do. That'd be ridiculous. But they turned it down because we were too small. We then went to NatWest, and the CEO of NatWest, we got to know, we had an office in America, and they had County Bank, and they said, delighted to do it, and they turned us down as well, too small. But we had a third bank, Bank of Scotland, and they said they've got British Lenin, and they said, we'd love to do it, we'll see you tomorrow. They literally came down from Edinburgh the following day, and I have to say they handled it brilliantly, and it went really without any, we had a minor issue, but they dealt with it. They were first class. So we had this great relationship with the Bank of Scotland and a lot of the people there.
And is that something that you would hold on to now and recommend to people, that you do get close to the banks, that you build a relationship with the banks for the good times and the tough times?
Yes, right. And be straight with them. You know, so I still remember when at Palace, we had one property in Exeter that was a problem, big problem. And I was saying to our board, I said, you know what? We have to tell people we've got a problem, you know? So we told some of our major shareholders, I said, we've got a definite issue with this building. And I think they like that, because they're used to bad news. People think they're not, but they are. You know, and we said, we've got this property let to a firm of printers, and printing isn't going the right way at the moment.
No, it is not.
And I said, you know, they're paying a big rent. We've already reduced it once, but I think there's going to come a time when they're not going to be there. And gratuitously, we had told them, and they did in fact go into administration. Fortunately, we knew what was coming. So we did all the reports, planning, all that sort of stuff. In the end, we sold it to Travis Perkins at less than what we paid for it, but nothing like it might have been.
Yeah.
You know. So.
And that honesty is important, not just for the banks, for your finances, is it? But it's important for you, because so you can then be prepared. If you try and kid yourself, I suppose, that everything's going to be okay.
It's not. You know, you've got... And if you get a problem, you've got to work out how you're going to deal with it. You know, is this a insurmountable problem? And you may come to the conclusion it is, in which case you can get out now with a small loss. Best thing, really. They don't all work out. But I think you've got to be honest with yourself. You know, don't kid yourself. Mm. I think that's very important. Be honest. And certainly at Palace, we treated agents well. I had a policy that when we did a deal with an agent, they were paid on the day that we did the deal. I was an agent. I knew what it was like chasing people for money that they owed us and we couldn't get it and all that sort of stuff. And I didn't want their reputation. Mm. So we always paid people. We told our lawyers to pay people right away. And I think that helped us, because we maintained fabulous relations with our agents.
Mm. So let's... there's a few things I'm going to come back to on that, but let's keep moving through your career. So Sinclair Goldsmiths, you float it, then you merge it with Conrad Riplat.
Yep.
Then you move into more of the investor, developer, owner world.
Yeah. I mean, we merged with Conrad Riplat. John was chairman, I was deputy chairman. Whatever anybody might say about John Riplat, one of the cleverest, shrewdest guys you could wish to meet. I learned a lot from him in 2 years. He ran British Land brilliantly, and no one's gone anywhere near what he's done. So, you know, so yes, I left after, in 94, I think I left. And I actually did a lot of consultancy work during that period. And also I did a couple of development things of my own. I did one actually opposite Miss Selfridge in Duke Street, which actually went very well. That was that. And then I got involved with this huge casino group in America, because I don't know whether you remember, super casinos were coming to Britain.
Yeah.
And they wanted someone in the UK that could act for them. And I did. We did that for 2 or 3 years. It was quite interesting. Amazing. All the American casino groups came over here. Tony Blair promised them the world.
Then failed to deliver?
Completely. They were courted by the old Department of Trade and Industry to come to Britain. And then they were let down, to be honest. I attended a meeting at the House of Commons where there was going to be an election. And I think it was 2005, I think. And they said, don't worry, there's this big campaign, Daily Mail, trying to stop it all. But don't worry, we're going to win the election and you guys are going to be fine. And they weren't fine. That was a very disappointing time. MGM went home, very upset, weren't the only ones. And we had all these options on different sites all over the country, and they all went to nothing. And they were going to spend hundreds of millions, you know. And the big issue, of course, with casinos was the gambling issue, you know, and problem gambling and all that sort of stuff. But I learned what steps they took to prevent it, and huge steps. But it wasn't enough. And the whole thing collapsed in a heap. And that was that. And then I started a company with my daughter called Mission Capital. And we went into car parking and property and all that sort of thing. And in those days, to go on the AIM...
All the sexy bits of real estate.
Yeah. So we in those days, if you want to go on the AIM market and you never had a business, you had to raise £3 million. So we raised the £3 million. And we went on the AIM, and it was all going reasonably well, but then the market started to suffer in 2007, 2008. But then we had a very unfortunate situation where one of the guys that came in decided he wanted to control the board. And we had just agreed, can you believe it, early part of 2008, we had just agreed to buy a building called Dorset House, which is in Gloucester Place. There's a petrol station on the ground floor. And the reason we were buying it was because the two lower floors were car park. And it was leased to National Car Parks at $400,000 a year, which is a hell of a rent. I'm talking 16 years ago. It was a hell of a rent. So the attraction to us was that their lease expired within 12 months. But we had to work out what profit were they making paying $400,000 a year. So we called in two independent companies to give us advice. And I sat in the basement in a car with every car coming in and going out. It was the most boring thing imaginable, but I did it. And I worked out that I thought NCP were making between 400,000 and 500,000 profit.
Whoa.
And the two independent companies, one was at just under 500 and one was about 470. So we're in that ballpark. So I suddenly thought, hold on a minute. If we take possession of this, we get the 470,000 profit. And we're not paying 400,000 a year, so we agreed to buy it. And I got the equity from a stockbroking firm that's no longer around called Colin Stewart. And I got a 20 million facility from Lloyds Bank. And I came to a board meeting to get approval to get on with it. Instead, we were voted off the board. And we had to go. And it's no secret, we had 17 months of litigation. But we came out of that litigation pretty well.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to disclose what was agreed. But we had the most fantastic QC.
This wasn't your finer chap again.
No, it wasn't. We used one of his ex-partners, a guy called David Sweet, who passed away a few years ago, but he recommended us to a QC called Gavin Lightman. And Gavin I knew because I used to act for Playboy, and so did he. And he dealt with all the licenses and all that sort of stuff. And I went to see Gavin. And Gavin was unique because he had been a judge. And you're not allowed to be at the bar, go to be a judge and come back again. So he came back as a consultant. So we used Gavin as a consultant and we used his son, Daniel Lightman. Two geniuses, right? I remember we were sitting down and this case had been going on for about 15, 16 months. And he said, you've got a bit of a problem here. I think you'll win. He said, the problem is we're not going to be in court for 18 months. And the cost to you on that 18 months is going to be a lot of money. So I said, well, is there any way you can shorten it? Yes. I said, how are you going to do that? He said, that's my department. You leave it to me. Within 8 weeks, we're at mediation. And we settle at the mediation. And we were not unhappy with the settlement at all. And we came away at 10 o'clock at night. Everything had been signed. And we kept our shares, all that stuff. And I still remember my lawyer said, right, you've finished this nightmare. Annabelle's? I said, no, bed. My daughter and I were absolutely gone, you know.
Yeah.
But we achieved it. And I remember saying to my daughter Emma 6 months earlier, look, let me deal with all this stuff. You've got to get back into business. And she went back into car parking, which she did. I said, I'll deal with all this. And with litigation, you've got to deal with it every day.
Mm.
And you've got to be very strong with it. But my solicitor was great. But Gavin and Daniel Lightman were just out of this world.
Like the letter, did you ever find out what they did? Or
what was that?
Like the letter that you never saw the contents of, did you ever find out what they did to reduce the time?
Well, I don't know what they did. Well, I do know what they did. I can't disclose what they did. But it was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. There was no way they were going to go to court. Hmm. We knew that.
Yeah.
But it's 18 months down the line. And I think that's one of the problems today. You'll get a court date maybe 2 to 3 years' time. And you think to yourself, well, I'm not going to go through all this litigation and all this cost for 2 or 3 years' time.
Mm.
But luckily I had these two guys who said, don't worry, we'll shorten it. And they went to mediation, which we did. And we settled it. And that was the end of it. You know, and it's quite interesting. You look back at that company and the guys that forced us out, they carried on with the company. And then it was literally dying. They didn't do any deals, they sold everything, and there was nothing, hardly anything left. And I went back to Gavin one more time, and I said, look, we got all these shares in this company. I said, because they're not doing what they're gonna do, it's gonna be delisted. And we'll have shares in a private company, which, you know, what's that worth? Nothing really. He said, you leave that to me. And within 3 months, the shares were relisted. They did a reverse into another company. It didn't go well, but we weren't there. And we got out. We sold most of our shares. So in the end, we did all right.
I want to talk to you about resilience, because you just talked through the Mission Capital experience. It must have been really hard and really tough. If you chose bed over Annabelle's when you'd just come out of something on a positive side, it must have been tiring.
I was totally gone.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, you've had a not dissimilar experience at Palace.
Not quite the same. I think I look back at Mission, right, and as a family we stuck together, my wife, my daughter, my son, we were all together as if we're going to win this thing or get over it. And then the people that backed me in Mission said, well, you haven't finished off what you wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we find another vehicle? And we did in 2010. We bought this little took control of this little company called Leo Insurance, which was effectively owned by the Lippmann brothers, Safeland, all that lot.
Mm.
And we did a deal with them and bought 29.9%. Changed the name to Palace Capital, because they wanted to keep the name. And we thought, right, we think the future's in the regions. London was moving in 2010, but the regions weren't. And our view was, it's gonna be a year or two before that happens. My partners and I have always been counter-cyclical.
Mm.
And we said, it will come back. So we looked at, so we bought, under the rules of the AIM market at the time, you had to make an acquisition within a year, otherwise your shares were suspended. And we didn't want that. The problem was in 2010, the banks weren't releasing any property. So we couldn't find anything. And I thought, this goes back to your door knocking, you know. Where am I going to find this deal, you see? This is the God's honest truth. I went back over the previous 6 months' Estates Gazettes, looking at any advert that I might have missed. And this was like in 2011. And in October 2010, there was a quarter-page ad. Property company for sale in Newcastle-under-Lyme. And we cut a long story short, we actually bought the company. I went up to Newcastle-under-Lyme, got hold of it, owned by a guy that built it up over time, wasn't big. We paid 1.8 million. I knew the guy at Close Brothers who lent us 1.2 million. We put in a bit of money, got a bit of equity outside, and we didn't stop ourselves getting suspended. The deal took too long. We got suspended, then came back within a month, and we had this little company. But then we said, well, we knew that you can't be listed unless you're of a significant size. So we had to look around for a deal that would suit us.
Mm.
And I did find one. But at the last minute...
Through the EG again?
No, damn, I knew it. A guy who agreed to sell me a portfolio, but it turned out it wasn't what we thought it was.
Mm.
And then we started looking, and then eventually I met with Richard Starr, who I didn't know at the time. And he said, look, he said, there's this portfolio Quintain have got. This might suit, you know. And we looked at it. We had never met him. We had a coffee, went through it, looked at Google Earth, and they wanted £47 million. And we made it worth about 37. So we thought, well, this is a bit of a waste of time. So I knew Nigel Kempner very well. So I rang him and said, look, you've got this portfolio. You want 47 million. I said, but I can't get anywhere near it. He said, well, we're thinking of taking it off the market. We can't get our price. I said, we'll never get that price. I said, what will you take for it? You know. He said, well, we're not taking less than 40. So I thought, well, that's all right. I've just got 7 million off. But it's not worth 40, but it's worth looking at. And what then happened is we got all the details, and there were 24 properties all over the country. Took Richard and I 5 days to see them all. And we thought, this is better than we thought, but it's not 47 million. And we got to about 38, 38 and a half, something like that. Anyway, cut a long story short, we go and see Nigel. And Nigel said, look, I don't wish to be rude, Neil, but your company has a value of £600,000. And you're talking to me about doing a deal near 40 million. Where are you getting the money from? So I've also learned in life that humour is quite important. I said, Nigel, you owe me a favour. He said, what's that? I said, your father, Victor Kempner, turned me down for a job when I was 17. So you owe me a favour. Anyway, he burst out laughing and he said, look, he said, where are you going to get the money from? I said, well, I said, you've got this portfolio in a subsidiary. I've gone to company's house. It looks to me you owe the bank 38 million. He said, we do, which is why I want 40. I said, I got it. I said, so I've been to the bank and they will give me a £20 million facility. So I've got 20 million of the money already. He said, that's fine, but where are you getting the rest? So I said, oh, we're going to raise it on the stock market. He said, don't be ridiculous. We've just tried on a company and failed. I said, Nigel, I said, you got to have the personality, old chap, you know. So he burst out laughing. He said, where are you going to, how much you got to raise? I said, 23 million, 23 and a half million. Well, where are you getting it from? So I had Stanley Davis with me, who's with me on this company now. And Stanley said, Nigel, I'm putting in 3 million just to get it going. And that changed the whole situation.
Hmm.
He said, that is different.
Skin in the game.
If you're putting in 3 million, I said, I'm putting money in, Nigel. He said, I'll recommend it to the board. And he did. So off we went. But then our broker went bust. Right? What do you need to find a new broker? Now, we're talking about a regional portfolio. And people forget in 2012, 2013, the regions were still not in favour.
Mm.
So we went to see 8 brokers in London. 6 turned us down flat. One said to me, don't be ridiculous, what are you smoking? One was quite interested, but one had an office in Birmingham. And he said, we've noticed a definite pickup in the regions. We can take it on, and we think we can get the money. So we had to raise 23.5 million. On the first day, we had 7 million. First day. One of them was from AXA.
Hmm.
And relationships are very important. about a year earlier, I had bumped into a fund manager who was fund manager of Sun Life, and he was our biggest shareholder in Sinclair Goldsmith. And he asked me what I was doing, and I set up Palace Capital. He said, when you need money, come and see me. And I said, where are you now? And he gave me his card, and this is where luck comes in. He's chief executive of AXA Investment Managers. And I went to see him, and he said, we'll put money in. And he did. And George Soros put money in. Polar Capital put money in. But after 2 weeks, we had 15 million. We were still 8 million short. And the broker said, we've only got another week, you know, because it was Regions.
Mm-hmm.
So on the Friday, the last day, we had 21 million committed.
So close.
2.5 million left. We've got another 500,000 by 10 o'clock. We're too short. And six institutions we're still waiting to hear from. And this is where Stanley's great. He said, Neil, I've got a meeting with some private equity guys in Mayfair. 11 o'clock. We go to see them, give our presentation, and the guy said, yep, okay, we'll let you know next week. And Stanley said, too late. He said, what do you mean too late? He said, you got to 3 o'clock. So this guy said, what do you mean 3 o'clock? He said, what about my due diligence? He said, how long have you known me? 30 years. Do you trust me? Completely. 3 o'clock. Okay. At 2 o'clock, he rings Stanley. But Stanley is in the Garrick Club having lunch. Well, you can't put your phone on. So he rang me, you see, and we'd asked him for 3 million, just in case. And he said, we've had a think, and we can't give you 3 million. And I swear to you, I thought he was going to say 1.5. But he didn't. He said, it's £2 million, which meant we had the money. But then he said, there is a condition. I thought, oh my God, what's this? He said, I want to go on the board as a non-exec. I said, what do you mean? It's not a condition, it's a privilege.
Yeah.
So he came on our board and we got the money. And that's how we got the whole thing going. And in that portfolio was the York building, which we ultimately developed some years later.
And you turned that sub £40 million portfolio into 280.
We got to 280 million, always kept the leverage low, didn't like borrowing too much money. So our leverage very rarely got beyond 40. It did once, but a very short time, then it started coming down.
And always committed to the regions. And
always committed to the regions. We love Manchester, we love Newcastle. Even Liverpool, people underrate Liverpool. It's much better than people think. Leeds, Birmingham, we're all over the place, you know. And even sort of less, not big cities. We had this wonderful property, they've still got it, in Leamington Spa. We had 1.5 acres in the middle of Leamington Spa.
Wow.
Offices, you know, absolute cracking spot. They call it Silicon Spa now. Yeah, so we were quite careful what we bought. And then within a year of Quintain, we bought another company called Property Investment Holdings. They had got into trouble with RBS and Lloyds, and we bought the company. And one of the things that we did at Palace is we bought corporately rather than properties, because on property you pay 5%, on corporate deals you pay 0.5% of the share capital. And we reckon we saved about 11 or 12 million in stamp duty on all the deals that we did. So we went out of our way to buy SPVs, even if there's only one building, rather than buy the property. So we saved quite a bit of money that way, you know. And as you know, I stayed there till June 22, and when we announced the best results we'd ever done.
Yeah. And then we started off this conversation with me talking about you can't keep a good man down, which brings us back to current time and you're working with Stanley again.
Yeah.
A reverse takeover of a small list AIM listed company again.
No.
Not AIM listed.
No. What we've done, with the same people. We've got a private investor with us as well. And Stanley was very keen to do another one. And we thought, right, how are we going to do this? And we looked at whether we should look at what we did last time. But the world's changed. The stock market has changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got listed companies in London looking at New York. You've got companies not thinking of listing at all. All that sort of stuff. So it's all very unpopular at the moment. But we thought, if we're going to get a little shell, we're only going to get it when it is unpopular.
This is your counter-cyclical again.
Because the minute there's a change in sentiment, we're competing with 10 other people. So we looked around. We found one 6 months ago on AIM. We thought we agreed a deal. We had agreed a deal, but they moved the goalposts. And I'm one of these people. Once they start moving the goalposts, goodbye. But in essence, I wanted a main market listed company. The advantage of main market is you don't have to have a nomad. And the problem with having a nominated advisor, if you're on AIM, is they can cost 60,000-70,000 a year just to have them there. And we haven't got that in the company we've got. So we looked around for another little shell. And I did exactly the same as I did with the last one. I went to the London Stock Exchange website and looked at every company under 2 million. Looked at all of them. And there's loads of companies in there that are in oil and gas and all that sort of stuff. And all other types of companies in different industries. But there weren't many shells. There's a few. But one particularly caught my eye. And I got in touch with a guy I knew quite well. He said, go and see the stockbroker. I know him very well. I'll set it up, which he did. And I met them at the end of August. And we were talking till well into October, November, slowly moving towards agreeing something. But there's always somebody that puts a spanner in the works or tries to. And suddenly a shareholder called a general meeting requisitioning that the existing director should be removed, and his appointee's gone on the board. So we couldn't do anything for about a month. They lost these people, and then we restarted it. And we tried to do it before Christmas. Wasn't possible. We ran out of time. And then we did it about a couple of weeks ago on a Friday. It's always on a Friday, isn't it? And we did it on a Friday. We agreed the terms. We now have this shell. So what we have to do is a reverse takeover of at least £30 million. That's the rules. And we're aware of that. So we're now looking at potential targets. But I've told everybody, this doesn't take 5 minutes.
No.
Right? You have to find the right target. And you've got to get your investors lined up. You know, and there's quite a bit to do before you do all that. So we've got this vehicle. The good thing about the vehicle is it hasn't got loads of costs coming out of it. It's got no properties. It's got the only costs really are auditors, stock exchange fees, a few other bits and pieces. And we had a firm of accountants do a due diligence report on them. They found nothing untoward. So that's stage one, is getting it. We got it just before, you know. And people, as you say to me, people say to me, why are you doing it now? Why are you doing it? You know. Well, my mum died at 93. And she said to me quite some time ago, look, she said, what's important, if you're lucky, is to keep your health. Your health is very important. If you can keep your health, keep your brain active. She said, I've seen too many people who've not kept their brain active, who've not been in a good place. So it is essential you do that. So, and Stanley, he can't wait to get going. I mean, he's, you know, he's older than me. But you wouldn't think so. And then I tell people, you know, Warren Buffett's 93. I haven't got his money, but he's 93. And his partner was 99 before he passed away, you know. And because they kept their minds active, you know. So the important thing for us is now we've got the vehicle, we have to read the market, right? And I spent the last 6 months meeting restructuring people, insolvency people. You're aware of the insolvencies within residential, right? There's a lot of it. And a lot of development schemes are not going to happen because there's nothing in it. It is an issue. Mm. So you've got that. So what we decided to do was get the vehicle, which we've now got. We might be a bit early, you know, maybe.
Better to be too early than too late.
But
though.
We thought, we'd, both my partners said, well, don't be too late. So we said, if we're a few months early, fine, right? And we'll do that. And we think we can repeat with Palace. But I've said one thing. I said, if we do the reverse, I'm not going to be CEO. I said, I don't think a listed company wants someone of my age being a CEO. So I've been talking to some people who may be interested in coming in with us as CEO.
We'll look forward to the EG exclusive.
Absolutely. but I think that's, you know, I've looked at everything. I think I have. I'm being realistic, right? So I'm speaking to quite a few people. And I've had quite a few approaches. And I'm talking to them, you know. And we'll see what happens. You know, but we're quite excited about it.
Yeah. It's really interesting, particularly when you were talking about Grandma Rose, as anyone who's on Instagram knows, your mum.
Mother-in-law.
And that you talking about keeping the mind active. Mm. And when I was thinking, well, how do we get to sort of packaging up these lessons from this? And one of the things that struck me from listening to your story is that you've always been very thoughtful throughout your career. You've thought about the businesses and how they operate, what the truth looks like in them. You've done your research, and you know that's probably got a bit easier as you've gone along, as we've collected more data and there's more access to things. But would you say, as we do sort of round up the conversations with those lessons for people to take away, that understanding the business of real estate and being thoughtful about what you're doing is a key part of the successes that you've had?
I think it's a key. I think what also has been very important for me is my charity involvement. So I had a charity group when I was 18 with my brother. You won't believe it, but we used to put on dances on Sunday night in the West End because they were closed and they were only allowed to operate if it was a charity. And I remember we used to have these great acts of the 60s, the Searchers, we had the Rolling Stones.
Wow.
When they were nothing, right? We signed up the Beatles, but they never appeared because they were too big by then. But we did all that. And I've always had that charity bit behind me. And I joined Variety in the early 70s.
Yeah.
You know, and I became head of the charity in 91. But in 91, 92, I started the Props. You know, which is still going,
and it's raised huge amounts of money.
So we've raised about 11 million. So I founded that with my golfing partner Ronnie Nathan, and we've raised 11 million. My wife's very involved in the wheelchair program. I was determined to get wheelchairs for disabled kids. People don't realise there's a million disabled children in this country. So, and NHS is just not good enough. So we've managed to provide over 2,000 wheelchairs, you know, and I've been fortunate to meet these kids, you know, and you realize how lucky you are. when you look at them and their parents. Very difficult for their parents. Yeah.
Does that, taking us back to that honesty word as well, does that keep you honest as well, knowing, you know, that you can help in some way, you can raise awareness, and just remembering that, you know, there is someone, there's always someone else who is in a more troublesome situation than you are. And as we go through this economics cycle, there are bigger things to worry about, I suppose, if that doesn't sound too crass.
There are. But I think it's important that, I think the charity involvement has kept me on the straight and narrow.
Mm.
Looking at people that are far less fortunate than me, and it's not just the kids, it's the parents who have a very difficult time coping, you know, and I've always found it very important. I mean, I think you remember that we had this guy, Matt King, you know, got injured playing rugby, mm-hmm. and paralysed from the neck down, and my wife went to see him at Stoke Mandeville, and she said, "What can I do for you?" And he said, "Help me commit suicide." I mean, who... with his mother sitting there.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what it was like?
Yeah.
And she said, "Don't be ridiculous, pull yourself together." She did, you know, and she said, "We're going to sort you out." And we got him a wheelchair, which cost £25,000 17 years ago, which allowed him mobility. And he went on back to school, got a degree, became the head of legal at Formula One. I mean, it was fantastic, but he unfortunately caught an infection during COVID.
Mm.
And he passed away at 33, you know, very unfortunate. But I look back, you know, at him, and he was a role model.
Yeah.
You know, and the great thing was we got him to speak at some of our events to disabled people to say, it's not the end.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm still very happy with the fact that about 6 months before he died, I made a bet with him. I put £10 on the table, and he said, "What's that?" I said, "Within 10 years, stem cell research will in some way help you to walk in some form." He said, "I can't see that." I said, "Well, take my £10 because I'm going to lose." And he laughed, you know. But you have to give them the encouragement, you know, and I thought that was quite important, looking back.
Yeah, no, really great advice. A couple of more things that I just want to pull out as we come to the end of the conversation. Throughout our talk, you've talked a lot about family and how important they've been for you in decision making processes and support from your dad right at the beginning to your mum to Emma.
Absolutely.
Would that be some advice that you'd give to people today, to use those networks around them to, you know, reach out to family and friends for support and advice?
Yes, don't be afraid to take advice, right? I remember my dad once said to me, he said, "If I'd have listened to your mum a little bit more, I might have made more money." He did, he once told me that. You know, and my mum was a wise lady. And in fact, my wife's mum, she was wise as well. You know, and talk to them. You may not agree with them, but talk to them. You know, and they've also seen life. They've been around as well.
Yeah.
And I think using your family and who are there is very important.
Yeah.
And even close friends. What do you think? You know, bounce it off them. I think that's quite important. But when I still remember when I first went on my own, right? That was my mum. She said, "Now go and do it. You know, go and do it." I've got to tell you, it's very quickly, within 3 days of our starting, there was a postal strike in the UK. And in those days, there's no internet, there's no emails, there's no mobile phones. I mean, there's nothing. We had a postal strike. But we were fortunate. We had a thing called a telex. Which most people never had, and that enabled us to communicate with everybody. And I then realised in 1970 how communication was so important. So, and they were on strike for 6 weeks, you know, and we were relying on direct mail, letting buildings, all that sort of stuff. It all went to pot. you know, but we had a Tillet, you know, and thank God we had it.
Thank goodness for technology in any of its form. But that brings us back, and I think it's a really great lesson that we started on, we should finish on, with if the post goes down, if the whole of the internet crashes, we've still got the ability to go and knock on that door and reach out to people and talk to people.
Well, I remember at Palace, I used to say, listen, everybody, the phone is not a red-hot poker. Right, I know you can email somebody, but call them. You know, it might help you a bit more. And when we had the COVID issue, if you remember, the biggest concern was, were we going to get our rent? And what we did in Palace is all our asset managers phoned all the tenants, all of them, 2, 3, 4 times, right? And lockdown came in March of 20. And we didn't know by June 20 what we were going to get. But in fact, we got over 90% of our rents. And if we weren't going to get the rent, we were talking about doing some sort of deal which would compensate us. So we always achieved in excess of 90%. And then it rose 93, 94, 95. So we actually did very well on rent collection. And that was mainly through our guys phoning everybody.
Picking up the phone and talking.
Picking up the phone.
Neil, it's been an absolute pleasure talking through your career and just listening to the joy. You always have joy about this this industry. Really enjoy it. We haven't had a chance for me to. You dropped in Playboy there, which I really want to talk to you about. But it'll have to be another podcast.
Well, I will tell you, the reason we acted for Playboy is Arnold Finer, my great lawyer, was Hugh Hefner's lawyer.
Okay, well, that is a completely different podcast, and I'll look forward to that conversation. But it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for sharing your story. We now make you a professor in the School of Hard
Wonderful.
Knocks.
Gratefully received.
So there you have it. Lesson 5 of the School of Hard Knocks completed. You're so close to graduating this term with just one more round of Hard Knocks to go. And this time, I'm keeping Who's Teaching Us a secret. So make sure you've subscribed to the EG Property Podcast, and I'll see you, metaphorically, obviously, next time when the bell rings for the School of Hard Knocks.